What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's Connor from Intelligence Squared. And before we go to this week's episode, I want to let you know about a very special offer we have for all our listeners. As many of you will be aware, we have migrated to the online space in recent months and launched a new subscription service called Intelligence Squared Plus. We've been having some fantastic debates and discussions from Mehdi Hassan on Iran to Thomas Piketty on capital and ideology. So if you would like to take part in these events, ask your questions to some of our speakers, and even watch back all our previous events, then please go to intelligencesquared.com and subscribe today with a special 20% off discount using the code PODCAST. That's PODCAST. And join us over the next few months as we deal with issues such as taming the coronavirus pandemic and look at the upcoming election in the United States with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. So get started today and join the debate via the link in our podcast description. And this week, we were delighted to be joined by Catherine Belton, author of the new book, Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Took on the West. And she had a fascinating conversation with Edward Lucas, columnist at The Times and a security expert on Europe and Russia. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, I'm Edward Lucas, and I've spent most of my life dealing with the region that we used to call Eastern Europe. And that included 4 years in Moscow as the Economist's correspondent there, when I briefly overlapped with Catherine Belton, who is our guest today. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Your book has had a tremendous reception, even though you had the misfortune to try and launch it in the middle of the pandemic, which is probably the worst time for publishing, although paradoxically it's a great time for people to sit at home and read books. And summing it up very briefly, what you've done is to explain really what it says on the tin, where Putin came from, who the people around him are, how they came to power, and what they're doing. And that sounds like quite a straightforward task. You could say that about Donald Trump, you know, Trump's people, where he came from, who his people are, how he won the election, what he's doing in America. But of course, there's a huge difference that the roots of the Putin system are absolutely buried in a mixture of fear and secrecy. And your book, and I can say this having read, I think, pretty much every book that's been written about this subject, has done the best job, the best possible job, certainly so far, possibly ever, in explaining this. So I want to start off by just asking you, what has been so difficult? Why has it taken so long for anyone to write the book that you've now written?
I think because I think it's because they are extremely skilled in the art of the cover-up. I mean, they haven't wanted people to know the roots, which, as you say very well, have been buried in fear and secrecy. I think what happened with Putin in Dresden when he was serving there as a KGB officer from 85 to 1990 is a case in point, and they actually destroyed all the records of what the KGB were up to in Dresden. They burned everything, or they shipped truckloads out to Moscow. But when Putin was running for his election as president 20 years ago, he also was skilled enough to give a series of interviews. There was one particular book of interviews that he gave as part of his sort of presidential campaign, in which which he said, of course, all these rumours of my sort of nefarious activities in Dresden, of course, that's rubbish. We haven't hidden anything. It's all there, plain to see in the Stasi records. And actually, they're not there. There's nothing left apart from a few fragments, a few photos here and there. There are birthday greetings from the Stasi to Putin, but that is it. There's nothing else.
Of course, it might seem, and Putin's defenders would say, well, this is really a pretty trivial question. You know, he had this career in his 20s and 30s. It happened to be in the intelligence services. But, you know, so what? Lots of people work in the intelligence services early on and then move into other things. And the intelligence services are naturally quite secret. So, yeah, it's not that big a deal, really. But actually, it's a tremendously important thing that we still don't really know what he was up to in the late 70s and 80s, and it is the key to everything that happened since. So just tell us a bit what you were able to discover about his career in East Germany, the Soviet zone of Soviet occupied zone of Germany, as purists might call it. What you found out, and perhaps also if there's anything that you didn't find out that you still think is a mystery that remains to be uncovered.
Yes. So I mean, what little there is to glean is possible to find out from interviewing kind of former colleagues from that period, and there are some records around of what the Stasi was up to at that time. Putin, when he was there, he was actually the main kind of liaison officer between the KGB and the Stasi at the time. It's clear that they were involved in technology smuggling operations, which again sort of were very instructive for how Putin would operate later, because they used sort of front companies, they used sort of very kind of money laundering techniques to sort of evade detection, and it was always done through a network of trusted allies. You know, they needed to get technology into the Soviet Union because at the time there was a Western embargo against any technology that could be used potentially for military means entering the Soviet Union. And Dresden was a real hub for that. It had a big computer factory called Robotron, which had cloned the IBM in the 70s and was continuing to be a center for such activities in the 80s when Putin was there. And what we do know from the Stasi records is that there was a close comrade of his, sort of a very round German named Matthias Warnig, who later became a key persona in Putin's inner circle once he did reach the presidency. And Putin was working very closely with him in the 80s. And we know that also from one defector who had worked with Putin at that time, who defected to the West. He said that Warnig was running sort of these technology smuggling activities through the guise of a business consultancy based in Dresden, and he was working very closely with Putin. So,
I think it's really important for people who don't necessarily follow this as obsessively as you and I do, that the root of the Putin system, or part of the root, is the overlap between illegal business and intelligence. And when I say illegal business, it's business that looks legal but has an illegal side to it. And it was one of the things the KGB was really good at in a kind of narrow way, was using business ties with the West, whether for intelligence purposes or to get technology that they couldn't otherwise obtain. And Putin was actually at the heart of that, which is now what we see in modern Russia on a much, much greater scale, with all the kind of fusion of political and business power that characterizes the modern Kremlin.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, I think it really what he was doing in Dresden was really a training ground for how he would operate later. It was sort of obfuscation, and also the fact that through some of these technology smuggling deals, they were also preparing to preserve their intelligence networks in case the communist regime did collapse. The Western German intelligence services also suspected that Putin was part of a special special operation being conducted by the KGB's foreign intelligence arm called Operation Luch or Operation Sunbeam, which was preparing to recruit a network of operatives from the second, third tier of political circles in East Germany that could continue to operate for the Soviets or for the Russian KGB, even if the East German regime, the communist regime there, fell, because they could see almost the writing on the wall then. Because remember, this was the end of the 80s. Even when Putin arrived in Dresden in 85, the East Germany was living on borrowed time, and it was actually living on funds it had borrowed from West Germany and not from the Soviet Union. I mean, things were sort of, Soviet empire was really on its last legs. But in those conditions, some of the technology smuggling deals that were going on at the time were also being used as a way to siphon funds. They siphoned hundreds of millions of dollars through these deals, which sometimes were just fake. There was one deal to build a hard disk factory at a plant near Dresden, which was to be the most expensive ever built in East Germany, and yet the plant was never built, and the money was siphoned off into front companies belonging, again, to a Stasi agent who also later became very key in sort of Putin's financial empire in Europe. So you can really see the roots of his regime in how he operated then. But what also became apparent as I continued research was also that it was also a training ground in active measures against the West, because this was another part of the Soviet Union's failings. And from the 60s onwards, the Soviet Union knew it couldn't compete militarily against the West, that it was lagging behind technologically. And so instead, they'd resort to kind of these so-called active measures, which to all intents and purposes are political assassinations. They are, you know, efforts to sow chaos and discord in other countries, and actually also include support of terrorism.
Very familiar from later on.
Yes. And we've seen that very clearly in the last couple of years as well. But what Putin was doing then, according to this same defector who left for the West, this defector told a tale of how Putin had actually been a handler for a notorious neo-Nazi who went to the West and then returned to East Germany, where he helped stoke the rise of the far right after the Berlin Wall's fall, that he'd also been trying to extract untraceable poison from a professor, and trying to extract it from the professor by planting pornographic material on him. No one knows whether this operation ever came off, but according to the defector, that's what Putin was up to then. And then I came across...
But Catherine, yes. hang on. We're covering too much ground here, because this is all just absolute feast, and I want to get on a bit to active measures a bit later. But I think that what we're seeing here is your demolition of many of the preconceptions. Preconception number one: the Soviet Union is history. It doesn't matter. Actually, everything about the Putin regime has its roots in the Soviet collapse. And this point about the money is tremendously important. The Soviet Union did go bust, but as it went bust, huge quantities of money from KGB funds and Communist Party funds were sort of sent in sort of financial lifeboats to the West, and were there as a reserve to then pay for the revanche of these KGB and former communist people to come back to power in what seemed like the sort of absolutely impoverished world of 1990s Russia. But your book takes Putin then into that world. He comes back rather sort of threadbare, downbeat figure. If he was a dog, he'd be limping with his tail between his legs. Yeah, I think they took their fridge or something like that, because there were no fridges to be had. And he has what seems like a rather low-grade job in the international department of the university, and then moves from there to St. Petersburg municipal administration. But actually, as you explain the book, this is tremendously important, because this is where you bring together the foreign trade expertise of the KGB, the criminality of post-Soviet Petersburg the levers of power in terms of what the city administration can do. And this extraordinary sort of mutant form of power takes shape, and Putin's right in the middle of it.
Yes, that's an extremely good description of what went on. And I think, yes, when Putin returned after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, his tail was indeed very much between his legs. I think even though they'd been preparing, I think the speed of the collapse took them by surprise, and they did have to kind of polish off and destroy a lot of documents at very rapid pace. And there's the very well-known phrase about how Putin felt when he was trying to ring for support when protesters were moving to encircle the KGB villa in Dresden where he was stationed, and he'd been trying to phone up the local troops to get some kind of backup, but he didn't receive any reply because they were waiting for a response from Moscow, and Moscow was silent. And for Putin, this was just total horror for him, that he couldn't believe that sort of Moscow had just let go of the reins and abandoned them. As it turned out, they didn't. The troops did turn up, but with great delay. And so, but when Putin came back to Russia, his first port of call was actually Moscow. And in Moscow, at the Moscow Center, he went to meet his old mentor and boss from Dresden, who told him rather than staying at headquarters, he should head for his hometown in Leningrad. But it wasn't actually a demotion, because if he'd stayed in Moscow, he probably would have been paper shuffling. But in Leningrad, what he did do, as you point out, he attached himself immediately to one of the city's rising democratic forces. He first approached, I'm told, another leader who turned him down because he just thought he looked far too fishy. But he did manage to get a positive response from his ex-law professor, Anatoly Sobchak, who just happened to be the leading Democrat of the city. And it was also kind of just very telling for what happened to sort of many foreign intelligence operatives of that era. They didn't go anywhere. And the KGB, in essence, wasn't a bust as many in the West believed it was. And this is one of the reasons why, I wanted to work on this book, because I think there was a lot of sort of information about what happened in that era that somehow kind of got brushed over in the tumult of the time. There was so much going on. There was so much chaos, such enormous change that people really kind of weren't watching properly what some elements of the KGB were doing. And as you mentioned, it was the foreign intelligence arm who'd been shifting all these funds into accounts in the West ahead of the collapse in preparation, because they were sort of far more clever than some of the more meat-headed types in the domestic service who were only involved in domestic control. But the foreign intelligence types, Putin included, had been preparing, and then when the fall came, they were in the shadows, working closely with the country's new democratic leaders. And indeed, it's possibly arguable that without their support, perhaps Yeltsin may never have been able to come to power. But that's another story in itself. But so Putin kind of was attached as deputy to Anatoly Sobchak, this rising democratic force, who very rapidly was elected the city's mayor. And from there, he worked in the shadows. And what was a real breakthrough for me in my reporting in trying to understand what happened to these KGB networks after the fall was when I met an ex-KGB operative called Felipe Turova, who'd actually worked with Putin on a very scandalous operation called the Oil for Food Scheme. And this was something that has been sort of reported on a lot, many times over since Putin rose to the presidency. It was seen as this great scandal and as this sort of first indication of his kleptocracy. But actually, what I found, that there was actually another dimension to it. According to Turova, this oil for food scheme in which Putin had handed out at least $92 million worth of licenses to crony firms to trade raw materials in exchange for food, which St. Petersburg vitally needed at that time because all the mm-hmm. supply chain networks had broken down in the collapse and this sudden switch from a planned economy to freed prices. And it was just total chaos. And Putin was meant to be running this scheme to bring in food. And so he'd handed out at least 92 million, perhaps some other estimates said it could be maybe a billion to these crony firms, and the food never turned up, and there was a massive hoo-ha about it, a big stink. The local parliament raised an inquiry, and
a very brave yes. a very brave woman called Maria Sally yes. actually investigated this yes. and was then so terrified by what she found that she's refused to speak about it ever since.
Yes, I think she did give some interviews, and I think, but she was very much frightened off. But she did, what she found was that Putin was handing out these licenses to crony firms, and he was handing these licenses out to actually sort of joint ventures, which also had their roots in this sort of KGB effort to move money out of the Soviet Union ahead of the fall in order to preserve networks. And what this Felipe Torova, who worked with Putin on the schemes, told me is that actually the cash wasn't just sort of you just being stolen to line pockets, but it was also being ostensibly the scheme was set up to pay off so-called friendly firms. And in Soviet times, friendly firms had been a key instrument to fund the KGB's foreign influence operations, the Communist Party operations abroad. Friendly firms were KGB-run intermediaries who very often sold equipment into the Soviet Union for infrastructure at vastly inflated prices, and they keep the profits and use it to fund either Communist Party operations or other much more nefarious operations. And Felipe Torovo told me that we had to pay our debts to them, and this was a mechanism whereby we could do so.
Yes. And I think, you know, for many people listening to this would say, wow, well, I obviously didn't know that the KGB was so adept at kind of money laundering and skimming profits. And I didn't know that the KGB, at least the foreign intelligence bit of it, proved so durable and survived in post-communist Russia. And I, you know, interesting to know that a man like Putin goes back to such a lucrative and influential job. But in a way, that's all kind of, you know, page six stuff. The thing that really makes people jaw drop is that this guy who seems to have sort of Teflon ability to avoid saying or doing anything sort of notable as far as the outside world is concerned, suddenly turns up in Moscow, gets a job, first of all, a job in the Kremlin, then the head of the FSB, and then suddenly he's prime minister. And the first question that people were asking was, who is Vladimir Putin? So how did he make this transition from a sort of obscure, corrupt bureaucrat in St. Petersburg to being the number two man in Russia, and in fact, you know, then the president designate, because he very quickly moved from being prime minister to being president?
Yeah, I think partly because he always had a network of support in the security services. When he was in St. Petersburg, he was being watched over by quite a prominent KGB general who'd been exiled from France and sort of sent back to the Soviet Union. He was watching over him. Some say that he was in touch with the former KGB chief Vladimir Kruchkov. I wasn't able to verify that, but what is true is that yes, he did manage to rise extremely rapidly through the Kremlin. And I think this was partly because he had some support in the security services, and partly because he was quite skilled at sort of presenting himself as being very unassuming, distinctly unambitious. Valentin Yumashev, who is the Kremlin chief of staff at that time and Yeltsin's son-in-law to be, basically explained that sort of in one instant in 97, when Putin was already deputy chief of staff, Putin actually offered to step down and resign his position because he felt he'd done enough by then and done all he could, and maybe it was time to go. And this, in fact, only burnished his credentials in the eyes of Yumashev, because in those days, the whole of the Kremlin was was a den of vipers, and to have someone who seemed uniquely unambitious really was a plus in his eyes. And plus, he was quite effective at sort of dealing with day-to-day tasks and also at being quite charming. And he always presented himself as a liberal. He had the distinction of having worked so closely with the former mayor of St. Petersburg, who was still seen as a leading Democrat. And Putin went so far as to help his former mentor Anatoly Sobchak escape from Russia when he was being pursued by old guard prosecutors, and Putin helped him sort of get whisked away to Paris. And this again sort of burnished his credentials in the eyes of the Yeltsin family, who were running the country then. And they were in a very tough position. And another thing that became apparent as I was doing the reporting was that they were really kind of facing a deep threat, not only by 1999, not only because Yeltsin's position had been weakened so badly in this terrible financial crisis of August 98, but they were also facing potential criminal prosecution over some credit cards that they'd been given by a construction guy from Switzerland who'd landed an enormous contract to
reconstruct Kremlin. He was actually Albanian,
oh,
wasn't
yes,
he?
Albanian, sort of but his company was based in Switzerland. Yes.
Yes. But it was an extraordinary sort of comic opera story. But it didn't, at the time, people didn't really, I think, realize the gravity of what was going on. That you saw, you know, Russia seemed to be in danger of falling apart. There were all these powerful regional barons. There was Yeltsin fighting, not in the best of health, to put it mildly, and the financial crisis, largely based on, because casino capitalism had not for the first time blown up. But people, there was a sort of very profound feeling that this was not really threatening, that obviously worried that Russia was a nuclear power. But it's extraordinary piece of rebranding that someone who was actually not very competent presents himself as competent. Someone who's from the sort of extremely anti-Western KGB presents himself as a Westernizer. Someone who is quite a bit of a Russian nationalist presents himself as a cosmopolitan figure, and that none of this and that his rise to power is seen as is broadly welcomed in the West when he becomes prime minister. So a great sigh of relief, and then he becomes president, and an even bigger sigh of relief, and people didn't really realize at all what they were dealing with.
Yes, that's very true. And one of Putin's great skills has really to been really to have been a chameleon. He's very skilled at kind of fitting into whatever environment he finds himself in, while kind of leaving his true intentions covered up. And he managed to dupe the Yeltsin family incredibly well, and as you say, the West for some time, because I think the Yeltsin family really did believe that he was liberal and progressive, and indeed compared to the alternative at the time, Yevgeny Primakov, who was a former spy master, and they saw him as a dinosaur of communism, that Putin really presented a much better alternative. And he kind of gave speeches where he paid lip service to liberal ideas, and indeed in the first few years of his presidency he did kind of unleash a kind of a series of liberal seeming reforms whereby income taxes were reduced and private land ownership was allowed. And so everyone was opening their arms to him, and none the least that Putin seemed willing to make overtures to the West. Everyone remembers how after September the 11th in 2001, after the terrorist attacks, then Putin allowed the US to use Central Asia as a transit corridor for its operations in Afghanistan. But Putin was always, he's very transactional. He was always expecting something in return from the West. And when he didn't get it, that was the beginning of a deep disappointment. And sort of more seeds for the fight back that we see today.
Yes, well, it's a very interesting point that he got away for so long with being seen as a sort of pro Western, pro business guy, even though he started almost immediately controlling the media, taking media channels away from the oligarchs, which you depict. Then oligarchs either kowtowing to him or ending up in exile or in jail. But there's one element we haven't touched on, which I think we just need to spool back a little bit, which is organized crime. I think people have got the idea that there's a sort of fusion of business and state power and spookdom, and that is all sort of more or less, you know, belatedly clear in the outside world's eyes. But there's this other thread of links to gangsters, which I think goes back actually to the KGB's relationship with the Soviet mafia. But this has always been perhaps the touchiest point about Putin's own biography, is his gangster friends. How much were you able to find out about that?
Yes, I made a couple of trips to St. Petersburg a few years ago. And yes, it's possible to fish around. There is some Russian reporters, very brave ones, who've also taken the lead on this. And, you know, I think they're definitely, when Putin was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, how they ran the city was very much hand in hand with organized crime. The organized crime leaders were essentially the footmen for his KGB. They were essentially the foot soldiers. I mean, they were the ones who would kind of enforce and keep the peace for them and make sure money was being sent their way. So, I mean, in some ways he was forced into cooperation with them. You know, I think for them to have had, for Putin and his cronies, it was very important to have access to sort of the city's main strategic asset, which was the seaport. It was the gateway for all imports and exports out of the city, including oil, that was controlled by some very fierce gangsters. And at one point, it seems that Putin was in conflict with them. This is very early on in 92, and he was forced to send his daughters out of St. Petersburg because he feared so much the consequences of this standoff. But eventually, the rest of his guys made an accommodation with this organized crime group, which was called the Tambov, and they basically jointly controlled the seaport with its oil terminal and various other operations going on there. And one ex-Moscow KGB guy who was involved in those sort of initial operations basically sort of washes his hands of the St. Petersburg KGB guys, because he says, look, these guys are the most ruthless ones. They'll stop at nothing in order to get power. And what had the readiness of Putin to join hands and join forces with the organized crime guys is for him like a real case that illustrated that this Moscow KGB guy would have nothing to do with them. But he said, look, St. Petersburg guys will stop at nothing. And indeed, they work very closely with the Tambov organized crime group to control the city's cash flows and make sure that they got their own cut. But it did, as you say, sort of stem back to this long tradition of KGB working quite closely with organized crime. They were always convenient foot soldiers for them, and also in funneling funds into the West.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1.
37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
And there is an absolutely electrifying anecdote, which I strongly recommend all the people who listen to this, who obviously will buy your book, I hope, of describing how a Western businessman who's trying to do a deal with the city's authorities goes to meet a mafia don in his lair first, and the next day meets the mafia don and Putin, a representative of Putin, and meeting in the same office in order to nail down the deal. But I think we must move on, because we could talk for literally hours about this, and there's a lot more. So I think that the next sort of big inflection point is, and we've seen Putin emerge from the shadows. He has his successful career in the bureaucracy, then he becomes Russia's boss, he deals with the oligarchs, and still the West is basically willing to cut him some slack. They say, you know, Russia, difficult place, he seems to be in charge, we can do business with him. And then there's this sort of quite sharp inflection towards visible anti-Westernism, where he takes the gloves off. And partly this is because the oil price is up and Russia can afford to do what it wants. It's no longer sort of begging for money from the IMF. But also because perhaps his view of the world has maybe changed or evolved a bit. And that seems to start off with the in about 2006. So talk us through Putin's sort of turn to open anti-Westernism.
Well, by that time, Russia's coffers had filled very fast, because, of course, the oil price had climbed rapidly ever since he came to the presidency. And by 2006, it was pretty high indeed, and the coffers were filled. But and also his men, his KGB cronies, had been able to take over much of the country's strategic cash flow by then, and essentially by subverting the country's court system and threatening any independent-minded tycoon with taking over their companies if they didn't obey, as they did with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, that story of the UKUS takeover that is so well known by now. And so really they were already able to flex their muscles. But as I mentioned, sort of maybe initially when Putin came to power, he had seemed a little bit, he had taken a more accommodating stance towards the West, and to what degree his viewpoint actually evolved from this, or to what degree it was stoked by disappointment, it's not really clear. I mean, I was told that sort of Putin was a bit of a kind of a Cassandra, you know, he kind of had some Western leanings, but he was also surrounded by these KGB men who had very much a zero-sum mindset and still kind of of hankered for the Cold War and saw nothing, saw it as their duty to restore kind of Russia's standing in the world or its standing as an imperial power. Only now they wanted to use capitalism as a weapon for restoring power, and as part of that they needed to take over the country's cash flows, and they were the ones sort of provoking Putin to take a stronger line against the West. But I think it was a kind of a gradual process, in that the KGB men around him kind of moulded his viewpoint, but he was also disappointed that, having made overtures to the West earlier on in his presidency, he was routinely ignored. Sort of after opening Central Asia up to US forces, he... Go on.
Mm-hmm. This may be one of the rare issues on which we perhaps disagree a bit, and I loved your book, I slightly disagree with some of the foreign policy stuff. And there's a great quote here, which is from Dmitry Manulsky, who actually taught Khrushchev, the former Soviet leader, that he used to teach at the Lenin School of Political Warfare. And he said, war to the hilt is inevitable. This is in 1930. Mm. We're not strong enough to attack today, but our time will come in 20 or 30 years. To win, we shall need the element of surprise. Mm. So we'll begin by launching the most spectacular peace movement on record. Mm. There will be electrifying overtures and unheard-of concessions. Mm. The capitalist countries, stupid and decadent, will rejoice to cooperate in their own destruction. They will leap at another chance to be friends. And as soon as their guard is down, we shall smash them with our clenched fist. And so whether or not Putin was provoked or started from a hide and bide, I'll wait till we're strong enough. But the fact is, we have seen a sharp escalation in confrontation with the West, including something which you touched on earlier, the use of active measures. This is not the old sort of Cold War idea of tank armies waiting to thunder across the North European plain. It's a very different sort of warfare, and one which plays very much to Putin's strengths in the KGB. So talk us through a little bit about how Putin wages his war on the West.
Yeah, it's a hybrid war, and I think really he was able to identify this crucial chink and weakness in the Western system, when the West was indeed just sort of lapping up the return of stability under Putin and not really paying attention or not really caring about the methods he used to shore up his own power and take over the economy. So I think he could see that for the West, that profit was very often the only guiding motivation, that all these Western companies were lining up to take part in the economic power grab being undertaken by the Kremlin, and they didn't really care about this sort of subversion of the legal process along the way. So, you know, he could see these weaknesses, and I think once you've been able to kind of gather sort of hundreds of billions of dollars under your command, you're clearly not going to spend it all on buying mansions and yachts. It's not just his power system is not just about kleptocracy. It's about being able to use these cash flows to buy off and undermine politicians in the West. And so I think a lot of it so stems back to sort of these early operations that he was involved in Dresden. You see the same type of kind of operations in which sort of money is siphoned off into front companies, and then some of the people involved in those operations, then there was a Stasi agent called Martin Schlaff who was helping move money for the Stasi to preserve networks then in Dresden in the 80s, and later Schlaff in the 2000s was caught bribing the Israeli prime minister, and indeed there was a criminal investigation into his activities then, and he was close to many leaders in the Middle East, and this is where some of the active measures began, and then they kind of spread very much further into Western Europe, sort of where you reach kind of 2008-2009, you know, Russian capital is pretty much embedded into the West because the West West has opened its doors to Russia in the hopes that sort of Russia's market transformation would mean that it was going to be part of this sort of Western-led global order, that it would have to fit to the West's rules rather than have, as did turn out, Russia try to subvert the West rules from the inside. And I think it does stem partly to kind of slight Western arrogance and sort of entitlement in not really caring, at least as far as lawyers, bankers and other professional services people are concerned, not really caring about where the cash is coming from. Okay, so it might be stolen, but that's not really our business. No one viewed any of this cash as potentially being a security threat, which it turns out it has been, because people haven't been able to track the money flows by now, because it goes through such a sophisticated web of offshore companies that it's almost impossible to trace. And now it's in our political system and disrupting the Western order.
And I think, and we sadly we don't have time to go into this in too much detail, and perhaps your libel lawyers will be glad that you can't, but I do want to talk a little bit about sourcing, because the story you sketched is, you know, a lot of people have tried to tell it. You've been, I think, uniquely successful in actually being able to get people to explain who did what when. So, obviously, some of your sources are anonymous and should stay there. But can you explain to us, how did you manage to get inside this story and tell it with such sort of granularity and such and such authority?
I think, firstly, because I had so much time to do it. I don't think a few other people have spent so much time working on the book. It's probably through to my own inefficiencies. I was able to talk to people for a very long time. And I think as well, I was very lucky in the sense that I'd been able to build relationships with quite prominent people in the Russian business world and sort of in other official circles while I was Moscow correspondent for the FT. And I was able to continue those relationships while working on the book. And writing a book is a real luxury because, yeah, you're not sort of interviewing people on deadline. You can talk to them sort of on a much more kind of personal basis, and you can go back to them over and over again and ask questions. So it was a very gradual process, and yes, I did spend a great deal of time.
We've almost got to finish now, but can you just tell us two questions? One, just tell us a bit about yourself. How did you actually, I know you speak fantastic Russian, and you know the place absolutely backwards. How did you first get into this? Where people said, who is Vladimir Putin? Who is Catherine Belton?
Yeah, good question. So, I studied Russian at university and had nothing better to do after I graduated than head out to Moscow, where I fast was able to find a job at a local English language newspaper there. I'd always been fascinated by Russia when I was growing up, and I'd sort of managed to land in Russia just as the Soviet Union was collapsing in December 91 and made a huge kind of impact on me. It was a totally different world and I was fascinated from ever after. So yes, I arrived in Russia after graduating in 98, and I worked at various English language newspapers and then for Business Week and then for the Financial Times for 7 years.
And my final question is, you've uncovered many mysteries in the course of writing this book. I just wonder, is there any puzzle that you weren't able to solve? If a fairy, or the Russian equivalent, would appear and say, the golden fish, that's the way the Russians get their wishes, and say, I can give you one wish, I will answer you a question you have not been able to answer about something to do with the sort of the Putin power system. What would that question be?
I think, would I be allowed to have two?
The golden fish is often very generous.
Okay. Well, then the first one would be, I'd still like to know more about sort of what Putin's operations were in Dresden. Obviously, I began chipping away at that, but I still think it's very much the tip of the iceberg. What was the KGB's involvement then with various terrorist outfits who were engaged in nefarious activities in West Germany then, including the Red Army faction? I had one source on that, but wasn't able to speak to anyone else. But I'd be really glad if I were to find somebody else who could speak about that. I think there's one particular person who's currently in jail that I'd like to speak to. And the second wish, again, it was, you know, it was quite a leap of, but it was also a leap I took with a sense of responsibility. I had one Kremlin insider who was brave enough to speak about sort of the possible Kremlin involvement in some of the terrible terrorist attacks of Putin's presidency, including the apartment bombings and the Dubrovka theatre siege. And this Kremlin insider did tell some quite toe-curling stories about possible Kremlin involvement in these activities in order to shore up Putin's position in power. Yes, a lot. I did find other circumstantial evidence that, again, sort of points to Kremlin involvement in both these attacks, including a Moscow prosecutor's report for the Dubrovka theatre attack. But yes, I think it would be great if more such insiders were brave enough to come forward and think. We might actually see that more and more, because I think Putin, although he's trying to enshrine his position in power for another 12 years, I think he's running out of tricks to play, and we're starting to see more and more internal dissent. So my greatest wish is that, yeah, more such insiders will start speaking out.
And that is the note on which you end the book, which is, in a way, a slightly optimistic one, sad for Russia, but perhaps good for us, that the KGB system sort of got eventually completely calcified and broke down, and that Putin has replicated this in modern Russia. I'm perhaps not quite as optimistic on that as you are, but these matters will be no doubt discussed by us and by others in the months and years ahead. So, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. Catherine Belton, former correspondent for the Financial Times and author of Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West. I'm Edward Lucas, Times columnist with the SEPA think tank in Washington and author of a book called The New Cold War, which scratched the surface of things to which Catherine has gone far, far deeper. And for future events and podcasts, please visit intelligencesquared.com and follow me on Twitter and Catherine Belton. And in the meantime, thanks very much indeed for joining us on this podcast.
Thanks so much. Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.